You're all not worthy. Not worthy.
Not worthy.
My friends, you have my word.
I am mighty.
Oh, I've heard.
Thank you.
We're not finished yet.
I accept your surrender.
No disrespect.
Team 4.
I swear.
My father.
All that power. I thought you'd hit harder.
I'm impressed.
You think this is funny?
Be my guest. Not worthy.
Put that hammer down.
Today's weather Thorcast says, we're reviewing Thor for Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a softly spoken Australian rock creature.
Mike DiCrescia.
How you doing today, Mike?
You know, I was doing pretty good, and then you murdered me with that pun.
You are now dead. You are a dead person, and mm-hmm. That is unfortunate. But we must move on, so we will continue the podcast with, I guess, your spirit. Is that what's happening right now?
Sure. I'll haunt you. I'll haunt you for the next hour.
You're going to haunt the podcast. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we'll move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Taika Waititi, the third film in the Thor series and the 17th overall film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We are talking Thor Ragnarok, baby. Are you excited to get into Thor, Mike?
Oh, when have I not been excited for a Marvel episode of this, Mike? Buckle up.
This is when we bring our A game, which is unfortunate because if you listen to this for the first time, you're...
It's as good as it's going to get.
You might as well jump off now because this is the podcast. But before we get into Thor Ragnarok, we got to get into some film news. Okay, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we got a few things to get through today. The first of which, Mike, is that Disney has announced the full cast of their Lion King remake. This is coming out in 2019, directed by Jon Favreau, who, of course, directed Iron Man, he directed Elf, he directed Zathura.
If anyone remembers. Who could forget that?
Yes, but more relevantly, if that's the term I want to use, why not? He directed The Jungle Book in 2016, the live-action Disney remake, and so Disney hired him for this one, and this is essentially the same. Now, I said the Lion King live-action remake. Live-action is a very loose definition in terms of what this movie's going to be. Picture The Jungle Book, but without the one live-action character, and that's what the Lion King is going to be.
Yeah, so that was going to be one of my questions, is at least Jungle Book has a human character that we could like follow and be quote-unquote live-action with.
Right.
So they're just not doing that for this, I guess.
I mean, there's no human characters in The Lion King, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, these are like photorealistic kind of CG. I'm assuming it's going to look similar to how The Jungle Book looked.
Right.
So I don't know how it'll play out in terms of how it'll look. But I can tell you this, the cast they assembled for this movie is nothing short of spectacular. They got that Disney money they are throwing around, and they are flaunting it. So we already knew a few of these names. Donald Glover is playing Simba, which is awesome. James Earl Jones is back as Mufasa, which is pretty wild. One of the big things is that Beyonce is playing Nala in this movie, which I assume means that Nala will have a greatly expanded role, because you gotta use Beyonce when you got her, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, she'll be singing all of the songs.
Yeah. Even the songs that Nala didn't sing in the original movie, Beyonce is singing all of them. Beyonce will sing Kuna Matata, and it will be magical, and it will win the Oscar for Best Original Song. And
correct.
It's not even an original song, because it was in a movie.
But that's how good it'll be.
That's how good
it'll be. They'll give it that award.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be a couple of original songs that are thrown in here to be nominated for Best Original Song at the Oscars.
Oh, yeah.
And the result will be Childish Gambino and Beyonce performing at the Oscars together, and it will be fucking incredible.
Holy shit.
That much.
I never even thought of that as a thing I needed, and it's going to happen.
Yeah. But otherwise, I mean, we got other cast members here. Chiwetel Ejiofor is playing Scar, which is pretty wild. Alfre Woodard from Luke Cage is playing Sarabi, who was, I believe, Simba's mother in The Lion King. It's been like 6 or 7 years since I've watched the movie. But then there's some spot on casting choices. I like this cast list because it is a mix of like some outside the box choices like Childish Gambino and Beyonce. You know,
that you said Childish Gambino.
Yeah, that one just came out. But there's a mix of like really like just outside the box choices, but also just like choices that are like so obvious they almost had to happen. Like John Oliver as Zazu. Like that's
yeah.
Like, that's amazing. Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen as Timon and Pumbaa. Like, that's, like, I never would have thought of those people as those characters. But at the same time, like, as soon as you say those names, I'm like, obviously they are playing those characters.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And they're going to sing Kuna Matata together. That's going to be, like, crazy. It's going to be great. And then the hyenas are Eric Andre, Florence Kasumba, and Keegan-Michael Key. Which is another great one. Florence Kasumba is kind of unknown, but she was in Captain America Civil War, and she's in Black Panther. She was Black Panther's bodyguard, I think.
Right.
But yeah, anyway, just a stellar cast all around for this Lion King movie. I still am not quite sure this movie needs to be made because it's, again, if you're just remaking The Lion King and it's still animated, why not just re-release the original Lion King with the new voice cast, you know?
Yeah, just redub the original Lion King.
Because that's essentially what they're doing. They're just going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to do the exact same thing. So, yeah, I don't know. But I am interested in this Lion King remake. And, you know, all these Disney remakes, I feel like have been kind of hit or miss. But The Jungle Book is one that I did like quite a bit. So I am intrigued by this new Disney remake. Also, Hans Zimmer is coming back to score this movie. He scored the original movie, which is another...
So it is just literally a redub.
Yeah,
so.
Literally. Like, the guy, James Earl Jones back as Mufasa, man. Like,
It's just the same
movie with Donald Glover. Like, that's...
yeah, which I'm down for, I guess.
Sure.
I wasn't particularly excited by this until this full cast came out, and now, I'm in. Now I'm pumped for it.
It's a pretty wild cast, so I'm definitely intrigued by the casting elements, at least. I was pretty blown away with the cast of Beauty and the Beast when that came out, too, and I was kind of underwhelmed by that movie. So, we'll play it by ear, see what happens. It won't be out for another 2 years, so, let's live our lives until then, Mike.
Yeah, maybe we'll be in a post-apocalyptic hellscape by then, who knows?
Right, maybe The Lion King will be our only source of entertainment by the time that comes out.
It'll be the only thing that survives the calamity.
Anyway, moving on from that, if the world is to survive in the coming years, we do have one other pretty crazy bit of franchise extension happening at Amazon. Amazon is currently in the process of making a Lord of the Rings prequel TV show. Mike, your thoughts?
Amazing. I believe this news was rumored a couple days ago and then officially announced today, so I haven't had a chance to read anything about it.
Yeah.
Coming straight from work to record this. So I don't know much about what's going on, but it seems like a real bold choice, I guess.
Yeah. I think here's what's going down. So we know basically nothing about the show other than it's going to take place before Fellowship of the Ring. That could mean anything. You know, that could mean the Hobbit times. It could mean way before the Hobbit times. Like, who's to say? Who knows what's going down with that? We know nothing about the story of this, like what characters will be involved, anything like that. We just know it'll be Lord of the Rings. It seems like Amazon really wants their own Game of Thrones. That's kind of the idea behind this. And they are willing to spend a lot of money to make that happen. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like Amazon is pretty big as a streaming service, but they are more big because they are also Amazon. You know, they are.
Yeah.
You buy Amazon Prime because you get free shipping on things. And also, hey, you get TV shows. Like, that's cool.
Right.
So it's kind of more of a big package. Whereas Netflix, you're buying Netflix or like HBO or something exclusively for their content. Right. Amazon has some critically acclaimed shows and some, you know, Emmy winning shows. Transparent is big critically. But I don't know of any like humans that watch Amazon shows. The average person, I don't think, watches Amazon Prime TV shows. You know what I mean? So I just don't think a show on Amazon will be a big like Game of Thrones-esque hit. You know what I mean?
I think it will definitely be interesting to see what fills that void that Game of Thrones is going to leave. I'm sure, you know, HBO will do some crazy shit to fill it. To like, in terms of that, like, kind of epic fantasy genre, like high drama that like has become a thing now, I guess. Yeah. Like, with Game of Thrones, Netflix recently announced, I think, a Witcher series based on the Witcher books and video games a lot of people are assuming is going to be a ploy to try and get that Game of Thrones audience, because that's a very similar kind of you know, high fantasy, high drama, high intrigue series.
Sure, that makes sense.
So it'll be interesting to see the race, I guess, between the Netflix Witcher series and the Amazon Lord of the Rings series to what gets that audience. I'm of two minds about this, doing the Lord of the Rings thing, because there is just such a rich history of fantasy material to mine. Like, you know, at least Netflix is going after Witcher stuff, which I think is, you know, a relatively recent from the 90s kind of series, and it's cool.
Yeah.
But Lord of the Rings is such a pillar, such a you know, landmark series that, of course, it will come back forever and ever, I think.
Sure.
And Tolkien wrote so much, like, created so much of it outside of those the four books that everyone knows. That's, you know, true. The Hobbit.
Like, you could adapt just the Silmarillion. You'll probably have a TV show right there. Like,
yeah, it'd be real seasons. Weird. Yeah, but you could. You could do it. But yeah, so, like, it's – and, you know, there's thousands of years of history there that, you know, this, like we said, all we know is it takes place before Fellowship, and that could be literally anything. So it'll be interesting, I guess. You know, I'm intrigued to see what they do, but I'm a little disappointed that we're going back to the Lord of the Rings again. I just want to see new stuff, I guess.
I'm calling it now. Tom Bombadil will have his own episode, and it'll yes. be glorious.
it'll be the untold Tom Bombadil story.
Yes. Exactly. I don't know. I mean, I think with this thing, like I was talking about before, you know, you have this like kind of franchise extension that's meant to like, I think the idea behind this is to prop up Amazon as a streaming service, like turn it into this juggernaut right. on the style of Netflix or HBO or something. But we're seeing something similar right now with a CBS All Access. They have a Star Trek TV show and, you know, hardcore Trekkies are watching it, I guess. But like who is watching Star Trek Discovery? You know what I mean? Like.
I feel like I heard – I might have misunderstood what I read somewhere, but it's going to eventually come to network, I think. They're going to like actually air it on TV one day.
Are they really?
Maybe that was like some wishful tweeting from somebody, or that was like a thing they had announced. I can't remember.
They aired the pilot episode on right. TV. Or they aired part one of the pilot episode, and then it was like, oh, go to CBS All Access to see part two and like that kind of thing. To try to get people onto their service. But I don't know, man. I just feel like I am intrigued by this. But at the same time, I don't know if I want more Lord of the Rings. You know, I think Peter Jackson pretty much knocked it out of the park with the original trilogy of Lord of the Rings movies and then fucking struck out three times with the Hobbit trilogy. So it's
just sullied the franchise.
Yeah, I really hated those Hobbit movies. But you know, the Lord of the Rings movies, they've never been like for me those like defining blockbusters, but for a lot of people they are. They are like the definitive take on Lord of the Rings right now. So I don't know what Amazon can bring to the table that Peter Jackson didn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think they're going to have to try not to do that, right? Like you can't I don't think you could ever try and recreate that kind of thing, or it would be a bold strategy to go for a TV series version of those movies, right? To like try and recapture that or recreate it. So I think they're just going to have to do something completely different, I hope or assume.
I did see one pretty funny tweet. I think it was from Nick Robinson who tweeted that, shout out to the one guy whose problem with Peter Jackson's Lord of the Ring is that they weren't long enough because now we have a TV show. Way to go, that guy.
Yeah, and I think I remember I heard somewhere that they already have like purchased or whatever they do for TV shows for multiple seasons, right? They've already like they want it to be more than one season.
That wouldn't surprise me. If you're investing in Lord of the Rings, you probably go all in on that kind of thing.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. But let's move on from Lord of the Rings, Mike. There is some other news that came out today regarding Spider-Man. Now, as you know, Sony has the rights to Spider-Man. They're sharing the Spider-Man rights with Marvel, but they're kind of fast-tracking a lot of different Spider-Man spin-offs, characters that are on the periphery of Spider-Man comics that they have the rights to, that they want to make their own movies for now that Marvel has kind of helped them launch Spider-Man and make him popular again.
Right.
Now, Venom is coming out next year. That seems like it's pretty much on track at this point. They're also working on that Black Cat, Silver Sable movie that we talked about.
Can't wait.
Which is totally going to happen. And now let's put this in the realm of also totally going to happen. Sony is developing a new Spider-Man spinoff based on Morbius, the Living Vampire.
I have got to know how Parker created it. The bite from the bat somehow made me feel stronger. Now I know what this hunger is. Like the vampire bat whose genes I have inherited, I hunger for plasma.
Michael Morbius? Messing with a stolen sample of my blood? I never should have left it at ESU.
Nope. That's not a thing. You can't make shit up, Mike. This is a serious podcast.
I'm not making that up. Morbius the Living Vampire is a Spider-Man villain who is a vampire, as one might expect. He's actually he made his first appearance in like Spider-Man like 101, I think. It was the very first issue that Stan Lee didn't write of the Amazing Spider-Man comics.
And they just immediately went to shitty vampire villain. That's amazing.
I mean, Morbius has, you know, been in and out of Spider-Man comics for many years. He's semi-popular among Spider-Man fans, you know?
Sure.
I honestly could really get into Morbius being the villain of a Spider-Man movie. I think that would be great. Doing a Morbius movie, like, by himself? That makes no sense. That makes no sense to me. Like, doing a Venom movie by himself makes no sense to me. Morbius makes less sense. Like, at least Venom has name recognition. Like, people know who right. Venom is. There's, like, pop culture, you know, people know the symbol of Venom. Like, people are familiar with him. They remember him from Spider-Man 3 and all that stuff. They remember him from, like, the animated series. Morbius is just a vampire. And he's not, like, you know, well-known outside of comic circles. You didn't know who he was until I told you that they're making a movie based on him.
Yep.
I just don't see this actually happening, but apparently this is in development at Sony, so I felt like I should bring it up just because we're talking about Marvel today, and we might as well, right?
I'm going to hold out hope for the Spider-Ham movie.
At this point, yeah, I think it's probably in active development as we speak.
It's in pre-production as we speak.
Exactly. Also should note it's from the writers of the new Power Rangers movie, so great. That's great. That's just swell right there.
Can't wait.
Now let's move on, Mike. I have a bit of pretty insane film news. Now, as you know, Mike, we talked about this a little bit last film book cast. The sexual assault allegations going around Hollywood are kind of extreme at the past couple weeks. A lot of people have been outed. Harvey Weinstein, of course. Louis C.K. recently. That one, I was waiting on that one to drop. I heard those rumors for years, but it was still very upsetting. But one of the biggest ones was Kevin Spacey. And that was, you know, such an insane thing. I had never heard anything about Kevin Spacey up until, you know, the allegations started pouring in. And the reaction to it has been pretty insane. Netflix has cut ties with Kevin Spacey. They fired him from House of Cards. They were supposed to release a movie with Kevin Spacey that had already finished filming called Gore, and they're no longer releasing it. And here is the craziest thing of all, Mike. So Kevin Spacey was in a new movie directed by Ridley Scott that was supposed to come out in December, and it's called All the Money in the World, where Kevin Spacey was going to play J. Paul Getty when he was kidnapped in the 70s, 80s, I think, something like that. The movie was supposed to premiere AFI Fest this month, I think like in November 20th, something like that. Sony pulled the premiere because of all the Kevin Spacey allegations, which makes sense. And the idea was that they would probably have to push back the release date of the movie. Like, they wanted to get it in time for the Oscar race. It's supposed to come out in December, but they figured the rumor was going around they might have to push back. Ridley Scott, who directed the movie, said, no, I'm just going to take Kevin Spacey out. With 6 weeks left to go before the movie's released, they are doing emergency reshoots, and they have recast Kevin Spacey with Christopher Plummer. Apparently, Christopher Plummer was supposed to play the role in the first place, and Ridley Scott wanted Plummer for the role, and the studio exec wanted a bigger name, so he went with Kevin Spacey. And so now he was able to replace Kevin Spacey with Christopher Plummer, which is kind of cool. But also, Ridley Scott did this without telling the studio that he was doing it.
What? I didn't hear that part, detail.
He called up Kevin Spacey, told him he was fired, called Christopher Plummer, told him he had the role, got Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams, who were also in the movie, to agree to reshoots, and then called up the studio and be like, here's what we're doing, and that was it. And apparently they're able to do this because Kevin Spacey only filmed in the movie for like 8 days. I guess it's a supporting role, but like a pretty showy supporting role. Like, it's a pretty big one, but like the idea behind it is that you're kind of searching for he's not the one who's kidnapped his son or grandson. I'm not entirely familiar with the entire story. It's based on a true story, I think.
Mr. Getty, how much would you pay to release your grandson if not $17 million?
Nothing.
But in any case, Christopher Plummer is going to be replacing Kevin Spacey in this movie, and Ridley Scott thinks he can still have it out in time for its December release date.
I really hope he pulls this off.
I really hope so, too. I don't even care if the movie is good.
I just wanted to hit the release date and just be fucking crazy.
Yeah, like Ridley Scott, man. I mean, this is the same year he came out with Alien Covenant, which is one of the more crazier studio blockbusters that we've seen this year. And now he's putting out all the money, like this totally insane thing. And this is basically without precedent. This has happened before where, like, you know, movies have been in the middle of filming and they need to recast somebody. Like the famous example is Back to the Future, where Eric Stoltz was cast as Marty McFly. And then like 3 or 4 weeks in, they were like, oh, this isn't working. We got to recast with Michael J. Fox. You know, this movie has been done filming for a while and it's coming out soon. So they gotta, you know, film all this shit real quick, edit it all back in the movie, and get it out in time. It's a lot, man. And I think Ridley Scott is kind of insane for even attempting this, and I totally respect it. And I think he can do it. I feel like this is, you know, it's possible. It's not like, Louis C.K. Also had a movie coming out called I Love You, Daddy, which played at some film festivals and is no longer being released because of the... because of the allegations. Also because the movie is like disturbingly close to Louis C.K.'s allegations that are surrounding.
Right.
But the distributor who was supposed to put it out is not putting it out anymore. But that's a case where Louis C.K. is, I mean, he's the writer, director, and the star of the movie. So there's no way you can just replace Louis C.K. with Christopher Plummer for that. For this, you know, Kevin Spacey only in probably a few big scenes in the movie. You can do it. And it's totally possible. So it's pretty nuts, man.
Yeah, yeah. Ridley Scott's a badass for doing this, for just just firing Spacey, just doing it without telling anyone. He's like, no, this is the plan. This is what's gonna happen. That's really dope. Yeah. I didn't know that's how it went down. I hope this works out a lot.
I hope so too. I hope the movie's good. Like Ridley Scott is relatively hit or miss as a director. But I am really just into his process and, you know, I see everything he does. So I'm into it. I want to check this out. Anyway, got one last bit of film news, Mike, and this is the happiest bit of news. It's been like a rough week in terms of entertainment news. Every time I check Twitter, it seems like another one of my favorite people is a sex monster. Like after this actually happened like a few hours after the Louis C.K. allegations came out. And so this kind of like made my entire week. Star Wars, Mike, is a sci-fi franchise that we're both pretty big fans of. Some people,
you might have heard of it.
Yeah, some people may know it. It's kind of a big deal. Ryan Johnson is another director who we're both pretty big fans of. He directed Brick, Brothers Bloom, Looper, Breaking Bad episodes. And of course, he is directing Star Wars The Last Jedi, which is coming out next month. And when Episode 9 lost its director, we were both like, well, why don't they just get Rian Johnson to do it? He's right there. They can just pull him off the set of Last Jedi and be like, boop, there it is. But then J.J. Abrams signed on and it seemed like Rian Johnson was going to be one and done in the Star Wars movies. And it's like, well, that's a bummer, but all right, at least we'll get Last Jedi out of it. Turns out, no. Rian Johnson, man, had much bigger plans in store for the Star Wars universe. And it seems like now Rian Johnson is officially developing a new Star Wars trilogy that will take place in a separate corner of the universe away from the Skywalker saga, you know, with the new characters and new locations and new things that they can explore. And that is just unbelievable.
That might be the sexiest sentence that's ever been uttered in the English language. Let's be real.
Yeah. I mean, just giving, you know, a director like Rian Johnson, who, you know, I remember when he first got attached to Last Jedi and I freaked out. I was like, holy shit, they got Rian Johnson for Last Jedi. That's amazing. And now they're just giving him this blank canvas to do whatever he wants in the Star Wars movies. Like, that is just amazing. Like, that's so, so cool.
The only other person that would make me as excited as Rian Johnson getting this would be Denny Villeneuve. Just be like, go make your own weird fucking art house Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
And I'm down.
It's bananas. And yeah, so I mean, I think the plan right now with Disney, because I'm a little curious about what this trilogy is going to be. Obviously, we don't know anything about it. But they're saying separate from the Skywalkers. And so I'm thinking what's going to happen. I think Disney's going to keep making those spinoffs. And I know Disney wants to make more stuff with, you know, Rey and Finn and Poe after Episode 9 ends. But right. I'm guessing maybe they want to take a break from them after Episode 9, you know, let people grow to want them again, you know, except you'll see them in 3 movies over the course of 6 years. And so it's like, okay, we can take a break from them for a while and do something else. So I'm guessing this trilogy will kind of be sort of a placeholder almost, like they'll do like, you know, the new trilogy and also some spinoffs in the meantime. And then after this whole thing wraps up, they'll get back into episode 10 with, like, yeah, let's check in with Rey and see what she's up to these days or whatever, you know? And that'll be, like, the next sequence of movies.
Yeah. Do we know what the third Star Wars story movie is? I can't remember. We know the Han Solo movie, Young Han Solo.
Right. And the third one is going to be the Obi-Wan Kenobi movie, supposedly.
Which oh,
is
that's right.
2020.
Yes.
So this is going to be at least 2021 or onward. So it's going to be a while until...
Yeah.
Until this new one comes out. But I think part of what also, I mean, so right now, all we know, I mean, he's developing this new Star Wars trilogy. He's definitely locked in to write and direct the first of the trilogy, and will be shepherding in the other two. It's highly likely that he'll make the other two, from what I understand. But this is such a huge vote of confidence for Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think my favorite tweet from all of this came from Rian Johnson himself. Who tweeted out, I think you told me that he tweeted it and then I saw it. Obviously, I already hoped that you liked The Last Jedi, but man, now I really hope you like The Last Jedi.
Yeah, he's got to be real nervous, I think.
Yeah. I think if Disney and Kathleen Kennedy are this happy with it, that they want to give him like just a huge trilogy to run with, like,
yeah,
dude, I'm pumped. I'm pumped for Last Jedi. I was already pumped for Last Jedi. Mm-hmm. But man, now I'm just, man, I can't wait.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that we kind of hoped when they announced the Star Wars story movies. We hoped they would do this with, right? Go somewhere completely new. We're going to see new stuff, new directors, exactly. New parts of the universe. And, we're getting quote-unquote new stories, I guess. You know, or we're getting new angles on old stuff.
Yeah, you know, and we're getting Young Han Solo,
Rogue One.
Yeah, Rogue One.
You know, stuff that we were already kind of privy to, but now we're going to get Rian Johnson just making whatever the hell he wants in wherever the hell he wants, yeah. And it's going to be dope,
exactly.
Hopefully.
What I'm hopeful for is that he uses this in the same way that Christopher Nolan uses Batman movies, where it would be like, you know, all right, I'll make a Batman movie, and then I'll make my own, like, cool, different thing. And, you know, that could be something Rian Johnson can do, like make a Star Wars movie, and then go make this other original project that he's had brewing in him for a while or something, you know?
Right.
Like with Nolan, yeah. I mean, he made Batman Begins, and then did The Prestige, and then he made The Dark Knight, and then he did Inception, then he did Dark Knight Rises, and then he did Interstellar. Like, he was able to use Batman to fund these crazy original projects, and in the process become one of the biggest directors working today. Probably the, like, biggest, most bankable director working today, because, you know, he was able to use Batman as a platform, so you can have, like, this crazy original movie, but you would say from the director of The Dark Knight, and people would be like, oh, I'll go see this. And then Inception was a huge hit, and people loved it, and then, you know, they were able, now you can say from the director of The Dark Knight and Inception, and it's like, oh, man.
Right.
So it's wild, man. I'm just so excited. I'm so excited for Rian Johnson. Like, I'm happy for him, you know?
He's just such a cool guy, yeah. And please, God, don't ever anything bad, please. It's hard to be excited for people right now.
Yeah, no, I get that. But man, I mean, just like Rian Johnson, like I used to listen to, I mean, I still listen to the Slash Filmcast, but he used to appear on the Slash Filmcast way back in like 2009, 2010. And like he would just like show up, review movies with them, and like play the banjo in the background. Like he was that guy, and it was like, oh, yeah. Man. So I've just been a big fan of this guy for a long time. So I'm happy for Rian Johnson. I'm so excited for The Last Jedi now, and so excited for this new trilogy, even though we won't see it for several years. Anyway, I think that about wraps up film news today, Mike. Let's move on into our discussion. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time for discussions here on Film Bookcast. Now, Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
This episode, or week, or whatever day, I don't know. It's been a long day for me.
It's sleepy time now. Yeah, I get it.
It's a time. It's a time in a place. But I have to discuss two things, the first of which will be the complete second season of Stranger Things. I mentioned it last episode, I believe, where I had watched the first two episodes.
Right, and I had watched the first two at that point. Now, at this point, I've only seen up to the first five, so I haven't finished the season yet. But okay. Give us your overall thoughts.
So I remember talking about in my last discussion that I was a little lukewarm, I think, on the first two episodes. And I couldn't exactly place my finger on why, and I still can't really. It just felt a little samey, but which is weird because I really liked the first season, so you think I'd be down for more of it. I think it was just it needed time to ramp up to get to the stakes that I remember feeling, you know, the tension that I felt in the last couple episodes of season one.
Right.
To come back to normal town stuff felt a little... just, I don't know. It didn't hook me so much the first two episodes, but I came around real big, I think. I can't pinpoint an exact moment where I was like, oh yeah, I'm in on season two, but it happened, and I had a blast with the back half of season two. It's only 9 episodes, I think, but I was down. It was a lot of fun. We get to expand the universe a little bit, or, you know, the world that these kids live in. It's still very much 4 kids on bicycles as the genre, but like, that's, I'm in for that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that nostalgia, you know, Stand By Me, the Goonies kind of thing. We get the I don't know if I mentioned Sean Astin shows up in this season, and he's a lot of fun.
Yes.
A kind of, you know, another wink, wink, nudge, nudge to the 80s.
I've been enjoying him, too. Apparently, that role was actually supposed to be originally played by Patton Oswalt, which I could totally see.
Wow.
As well.
But, yeah.
Yeah, then he wasn't available, so they got Sean Astin instead.
What a great backfill. that's a lot of fun. But there is a particular one episode that felt real out of place and was... You didn't get to it yet.
I have heard of it. I've seen people talk about it on Twitter. It's like episode 7, right?
Yeah, 7 or 8. I can't remember exactly which one.
Okay, yeah, I don't really know that much about it, but I know it kind of like moves the action away from everything else that's happening on the show kind of thing.
Yeah, we go to a different location to follow a character there, and it just has really nothing to do with what's going on in the rest of the season. And it definitely serves as a kind of, you know, hint at what larger things happening and you know, as a season 2 expanding the world kind of plot for that episode. But at the same time, I'm there for what's going on in Hawkins, Indiana, and I don't really care what's going on in this other town, and I'd rather just be back in the main story for that whole hour. But it is kind of cool. You know, I see what they're trying to do, you know, leaving stuff open, winking for hoping for a season 3, I assume.
I mean, I'm pretty confident a season 3 will happen. It's not like it's you know. It's probably the biggest hit Netflix has right now, especially now that House of Cards is kind of a...
Right. Oh, yeah.
Not so much happening anymore. Or if it is, without its big star.
Although House of Cards with just Robin Wright would be kind of dope.
I mean, I think that's probably what's going to happen, honestly. I kind of dropped off House of Cards after like season 2, like halfway through season 2 of that show. So I haven't followed it in many years. From what I gather, I think the end of season 5 kind of almost sets it up so that like you could write out Kevin Spacey if you needed to.
Right.
So, yeah, that's cool. But that's not what we're talking about right now. Stranger Things is the thing.
With Stranger Things, yeah. I think, you know, it's become one of the big memes, I think, coming out of season 2. But following Steve and his 4 children, basically, Steve Harrington, the character, babysitting these kids through monster adventures. I want that Scooby-Doo spinoff. I need that to be a thing. Steve and the kids needs to be a thing. It's okay. Amazing. And that whole sequence, I think there's, you know, I think it happens over 2 episodes, the last 2 episodes. It's just so much fun, and it's that pure, like, kids adventure movie thing, you know, with, like, the older brother gets dragged along and, like, that whole kind of dynamic.
Right.
And it's just, it's so much fun. That's just one of my favorite parts about, like, Stranger Things. As much as it leans so heavily on nostalgia, it's still, like, just that kind of fun kids adventure movie vibe.
Right.
Also steeped in Eldritch horror. So like we get weird Lovecraftian shit happening.
Right. Yeah. I'm with you. I mean, I've been pretty open about my liking Stranger Things season 1, but not being crazy about it. I feel like I am enjoying season 2 a lot more. I mean, I'm only 5 episodes in, and I'm still not like as in love with it as a lot of people are. But I feel like I'm much more invested in what's going on the show, all the characters and stuff. There are still, I think, issues with it. I think the show kind of stops dead anytime it focuses on Nancy Wheeler and Jonathan. I think those characters are kind of boring. Also, like in the battle of Jonathan versus Steve is obviously a better character and a cooler person. So I don't know why you would go for Jonathan at all. But in any case.
But Jonathan's the weird, mysterious one, man.
Yeah, I guess. He's just kind of...
Yeah, I don't know.
But I don't know. But I am really enjoying the season a lot more than the first one. And I think part of it, I mean, you know, the homages in the first one, like they felt very overt and very like obvious. And season 2, they're still pretty obvious, but I don't know. Like the homages feel like they're being subverted in a weird way. I think my favorite thing about the season so far is that I think it's episode 2. It kind of sets it up where it's going to be like an homage to E.T., where like you have Dustin discovering the monster, like the whatever thing in his garbage can or whatever. But then in episode 3, that E.T. homage kind of morphs into a Gremlins homage, complete with like a musical sting that is very similar to the Gremlins theme song. And I was like, okay, shit, yeah, I'm into this. I dig this. Because I was sort of rolling my eyes at the E.T. homage, because everybody does E.T. Like, everybody does homage to E.T. Legends of Tomorrow just did an E.T. episode.
like, Jesus.
You know, like, that's a thing that everybody does. Nobody does Gremlins, though. Like, that's pretty cool. So, yeah, I am enjoying the season a lot more than the first one, and I am eager to finish the last couple episodes.
Yeah, and it definitely does have the very much a boys club problem still in season 2. You know, we have the new addition of Mad Max, who's fucking awesome. I love that character. But it is still... the only girls allowed to hang out with the boys are the ones they want to date or, you know, have crushes on and stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I would like to see them break out of that in season 3 and kind of move away from that 80s tropey stuff that, you know, that is very much part of the genre. But in 2017, you can find ways to use the trope against itself, I think, probably.
Yeah.
So hopefully they're able to break out of that. And, you know, they're it's still a good show, I guess, as a straight white man who has, you know, opinions on stuff.
There you go.
That must be heard, Mike. speaking of opinions that must be heard, I have another discussion.
Oh,
I forgot.
What?
Hey, look out. Coming in big. This weekend, I saw the new film from director Kenneth Branagh. Oh. You may have heard of him.
Talking about white people.
Talking about white guys making stuff, feeling important. He directed and starred in another adaptation of Murder on the Orient Express.
So they got him after all. You assume he was killed?
No, not murderers. Well, he was in perfectly good health. He had his enemies.
Indeed, he was murdered.
God, a murder here. God rest his soul.
Someone was rummaging around my cabin in the middle of the night. No one would listen to me.
If there was a murder...
What is going on?
Then there was a murderer. The murderer is with us.
And every one of you is a suspect.
The ever-present Agatha Christie story.
Yes.
That will always be around, probably. and it's I had a ton of fun with it. I don't think I've ever read it, so I wasn't expecting. I didn't know where this story goes, what the twists were. But it's, you know, one of the, you know, kind of archetypal detective stories. So it was fun. It's kind of silly. It's fun to watch Kenneth Branagh and this insane ensemble cast that has pretty sure every human in it that's ever been in a movie.
Right.
Daisy Ridley, Judi Dench, Willem Dafoe, Johnny Depp. Everybody's in this movie.
Leslie Odom Jr., who played Burr in Hamilton, is in this
movie. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. And he was fucking awesome.
Pretty excited about that. I also saw Murder on the Orient Express. Josh Gad, you're talking
Josh
about.
Gad, yeah.
Who's actually pretty good in this movie, which yeah. Normally he kind of annoys me, but he was good in this movie. But yeah, I also saw Murder on the Orient Express this past weekend, too. And yeah, I thought it was fun. I don't know.
Yeah.
I felt like it was I think I described it as a perfectly pleasant waste of time.
That is exactly what it was. Yeah, it was a fun period romp to watch 12 actors I kind of like hang out on a train.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
That's pretty great. Yeah, that's a perfect description, I think. And Kenneth Branagh is having a lot of fun in the role, too, as Hercule Poirot. His mustache is its own character, essentially, mm-hmm. and this should be called Mustache in the Orient Express. I think it would be if there wasn't a murder on it. I feel like that might take the mustache might take precedent. But I do like the kind of how he kind of fills out that character, where he's just like the kind of person who chuckles aloud at Tale of Two Cities, like...
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, ho, 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 Dickens, you cur, or something, like whatever he says. It's,
pretty much, yeah.
You know, it's fun. I enjoyed it. I feel like it's a very flat adaptation of the movie in some respect, of the book in some respect. I've never read the book or anything, but I've seen other Agatha Christie novels adapted to screen, and I don't know, I feel like whatever, like the twist at the end of this movie, like it didn't really work for me, I guess. But that might, I feel like that might have been in the execution. Like if it was somewhere else, I don't know. For me, like it didn't really work towards the end. But it was just like it was a fun ride, a train ride,
yeah,
might say.
Hey, look at that. It definitely felt like that twist at the end. Definitely feels like a. Oh man, I don't know exactly when it was published, but like, you know, a late, like an 1890s kind of twist. Right? Like, just like one of the, like, just a kind of straightforward play on what you were expecting, I guess. I don't, you know? But I think there is some pretty cool camera work stuff going on. You know, they, Brana is a pretty competent director, I think. So he makes some interesting use of the train cars and just like the train as a set, which is kind of interesting, you know. Yeah. But it definitely feels like a just straightforward adaptation of this with lots of ham happening every now and then, which is fine. I'm down with that.
Yeah. Cool beans. So that's your discussions, Stranger Things and Murder on the Orient Express. And now I've got quite a few movies I want to get through, Mike. We are nearing the end of 2017, and so at this time of the year, I kind of usually take time to do my 2017 catch-up. I try to catch up on some of the movies that I've missed throughout the past year, and so I've got a lot of those to discuss. But the first one I want to talk about is The Meyerowitz Stories.
The owner of this place is a client. That's why we could get a table so last minute. That's why they gave us this bigger table. I imagine they'll send some complimentary stuff, too.
$55 for a steak?
Known for their meat here.
And $35 for a salmon? You get the salmon to blow you for that price?
Okay, this is the new movie from Noah Baumbach, director of While We're Young, Frances Ha, Mistress America, which is one of my favorite movies of 2 years ago. And it's a Netflix original. It's on Netflix right now. You can go view it if you so choose. But this stars Dustin Hoffman, Adam Sandler, Ben Stiller, and Emma Thompson, and a whole bunch of other people. And this is really, really good. I mean, it's incredibly just like sharply written. It's very funny. It's got terrific performances all around. Dustin Hoffman in particular is like excellent as the patriarch of the Meyerowitz family. Also, Adam Sandler, amazing in this movie.
Wow.
Like a next level Adam Sandler performance. He's not been this good since at least Funny People. Probably not since Punch Drunk Love. Like this is the dramatic Adam Sandler that we all missed. You know what I mean?
Oh man, what a pull for Adam Sandler movies. I mean, you're definitely right. That's just not what everyone I know ever thinks of.
Okay, I mean, but in any case, like I really enjoyed the Meyerowitz Stories. I'm not sure if this ranks up there. I think Mistress America is still my favorite of his.
I'll bet Dylan is still in love with me. Marrying Mimi Claire is like buying a cashmere sweater from Old Navy.
Even if he's not, this is a great investment. And don't forget, she still owes you.
Yeah, it's win-win. Because I'm sure he still loves me.
I'm not driving you to Connecticut to break up a marriage. I should be in my room reading Nicomachean Ethics.
Oh, calm down, rich boy.
I'm not rich.
Yes, you are. You have a car.
No, I'm not. My dad is a mechanic. He and my uncle have a body shop. I had this car because it was something he could give me.
Sorry. I think I offended your boyfriend.
He's not her boyfriend. He's mine.
Why are you here?
Because Tracy made Tony drive you.
But why did you come?
I had a bad experience with adultery before. My last boyfriend committed adultery when we were together, and I just don't like to let my boyfriends get too far.
Adultery? Why the fuck does it matter? You're all 18. Where is this old person morality coming from? There's no cheating when you're 18. You should all be touching each other all the time.
Noah Baumbach, man, he does just really sharp stuff. There's a great like screwball comedy element to this, but it's also seeped in like this pretty intense emotional drama, and it's just like it's very funny. It's another really strong entry for Baumbach, so wanted to bring that up. And it is a Netflix original, so it is streaming on all of your devices right now. And then I wanted to mention a movie called Personal Shopper, which is directed by Olivier Assayas and stars Kristen Stewart, who starred in his film Clouds of Sils Maria a couple years ago, which I really loved. So I was pretty excited about this. And I enjoyed this not as much as Clouds of Sils Maria, but it is a really interesting movie. It's a movie about Kristen Stewart, who plays this sort of psychic medium who can sense ghosts and spirits. And she had a twin brother who died several months ago. And so the movie's kind of about her processing that death and also trying to get in contact with his spirit. And then suddenly she starts getting texts from a mysterious number that she thinks may be her dead brother. And a lot of the movie is just Kristen Stewart staring at her phone, and it is riveting. It is it is really good. Honestly, Kristen Stewart has turned into one of my favorite actresses, and I never thought I would say that 10 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do remember hearing a lot of praise for Personal Shopper, so I'll have to keep an eye out for it.
It's well worth checking out. It's on Criterion Collection right now. They put out the Blu-ray for it. And it also has one of the best endings I've seen in a film this year, I think. It might be the best ending of any movie this year. So well worth checking out, Personal Shopper. I also wanted to talk about David Lynch, The Art Life, which is a new documentary about David Lynch, the director who I have expressed quite a fondness for over the past over the past year or so.
Doesn't ring any bells.
Pretty much every week when Twin Peaks: The Return was on the air. Yeah, this is a new documentary about David Lynch that is as weird and strange and idiosyncratic as any of the director's actual movies. And this kind of focuses on his career as a painter living in Boston and Philadelphia, and then his transition to short films that culminated with him working on Eraserhead. So it's just kind of – a lot of the movie is just David Lynch – telling stories and talking about his childhood and like his life as a teenager and college kid, while overlaid with images of David Lynch like painting and doing different like painting, like artistic things, or hanging out with his granddaughter or stuff like that. Like there's and it's just really fascinating. I mean, David Lynch is a guy I could watch talk for hours. This movie's only 90 minutes, but I felt like I could just watch it for a much longer period than that. And I said the same thing when I talked about Spielberg the documentary.
Right.
Last time we had this, last time we did the podcast. But this one is a much more interesting documentary than Spielberg, just because Spielberg was a movie that kind of just went through every movie in Spielberg's career, which is great. But, you know, a lot of that was, it kind of just went through the hits. It didn't go into like the smaller stuff. This is going through a period of David Lynch's career that I don't really know that much about. And so it was kind of exploring something that I think most people don't know that much about David Lynch. And it's actually like the entire movie is just kind of his stream of conscious storytelling, and there's some fascinating stuff. I mean, he's talking about how his roommate in college was one of the founding members of the Jay Giles band, and how there was one night where he went to a Bob Dylan concert with this girl, and something happened and he left, and then his roommate came back and just shouted at him like, "Nobody leaves during a Bob Dylan concert," and David Lynch goes, "Fuck you, I leave during Bob Dylan concerts," and like.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then he's just describing stories about things that happened to him that sound like they would happen in a David Lynch movie. You know, like there's a story that he had from when he was a kid where he's playing with his brother in the middle of a street. And then suddenly this naked woman shows up who's bleeding from the mouth and just sits down on the sidewalk. And he's just like terrified. And like, that's it. That's all he saw of her again. I'm like, that shit would happen in fucking Twin Peaks. Like, what?
I'm pretty sure it did happen. In Twin Peaks.
It might have. Yeah, there's just some really fascinating stuff going on in David Lynch, the art life. And it's streaming right now on Amazon Prime. I believe it might be an Amazon original. I'm not sure. But it's definitely worth checking out if you like David Lynch's work at all. It's a peek behind the curtain of his mindset and his worldview. And it's pretty cool on that front. Anyway, I got two more movies I wanted to talk about. The first of which is The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is the new movie directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, who's the director of The Lobster, which came out last year. He also did this movie called Dogtooth many years ago, which I was a big fan of in high school. And this stars Colin Farrell, Nicole Kidman, and the kid Cillian Murphy killed in Dunkirk. He's in this movie. He plays a major role in this movie. He's great in it. Like, he's so like unsettling in this movie. And I don't really want to get too – I don't know if I could like – properly explain the plot of this movie. I can tell you.
I wonder what the IMDb plot synopsis is.
That's a good question. I didn't actually check. But this, I will say, this is much more Dogtooth than it is The Lobster, which
is a thing 8 people will understand.
So, have you seen any of the movies by Yorgos Lanthimos, Mike?
I've heard a lot about them though. I've never actually watched them.
He's a very he's a very off-putting director, and he's sort of in the David Lynch mold where, like, you know, he puts a lot of weird stuff into his movies, and it's very much there's a lot of deadpan comedy. I would describe everything he does as a dark comedy, but I don't know. I feel like this movie, I basically liked it. It's odd and it's dark and it's funny. It's disturbing as hell. But compared to The Lobster, like The Lobster, I thought was a lot more interesting. It had all those things, but it had much more to say, I think, about what it was going for. And I think this movie doesn't really have like a central thesis behind it. It is just kind of like dark for the sake of being dark, weird for the sake of being weird. And I think it works on that front. Like, I was pretty fascinated by it the whole time, but I'm not sure I would watch it again. I don't know if I could take it again. I don't know if I could put myself through this again. I'm saying. But I think it is worth watching. Colin Farrell is really like funny in it. Like, there's a lot of like really dark humor throughout this movie. Some weird like off kilter line readings. Nicole Kidman's good, and again the kid I forget the actor's name, but the kid that Cillian Murphy killed in Dunkirk.
That's his new. That's what it says on his SAG card.
It says that on the poster, actually. he is really just like unsettling in this movie, like really, really tough to watch a lot of the time. And this movie ends in a really dark place, and it's I don't know how I feel about it, but I was fascinated by the journey in any case.
I want to check in a follow-up on a tweet you had that you walked into the theater and there was an elderly couple in the theater sitting near you. Did you happen to overhear or notice their reactions at the end of the film?
I didn't. They were a few rows ahead of me, but they stayed the entire time, which I was surprised by. It was actually a fairly packed theater for The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I was shocked by because I was at my local mall, at the Galleria Mall, and I guess it was a Saturday and it was pretty cold out, so I think people were just going to the movies to go. And so there was a lot of people in my theater for The Killing of a Sacred Deer, but as soon as it ended, I did hear one person go, "What the fuck did we just watch?"
That's the sign of a good movie. That's awesome.
So that is The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And finally, I have one more movie to talk about, Mike, and this is an interesting one. It's called Your Name.
Now that you mention it, I do feel like I've been having weird dreams lately. I could dream about someone else's life.
What is this? What?
What does this mean?
In our dreams, that girl and I... We're switching places?
Have you heard of this at all, Mike?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay, this came out in March or April. This is an anime movie. Now, I've never been a big anime guy. You know this. I think I've talked about this in the podcast before. Mm-hmm. So I hope this recommendation goes a pretty long way. Your Name is my favorite movie out of the ones I've talked about today.
Wow.
I'm not going to guarantee this, but it might make my top 10 this year. Like,
damn,
this movie's pretty incredible. I was kind of floored by Your Name. This is directed by Makoto Shinkai, who I guess is a rising star in the anime community. I think he's directed one or two movies before this. But it's this movie. I don't want to spoil too much about it, but basically the thesis of this movie is that it's about this boy and girl, one who lives in Tokyo, one who lives in this remote village, who starts swapping bodies and they don't know why. Their minds just start switching randomly one day, and it kind of builds from there. And it's very funny. It's a very emotional story. It's very much about the power of human connection. And I was enjoying it for the first 45 minutes. It's about an hour 45 long. For the first 45 minutes, I was like, yeah, it's pretty good. I'm enjoying this. But then there's this one story beat that changes the entire movie and just left me hooked. I was in and kind of floored that it went there. And it's really a powerful movie. And I was shocked by how much I like this. Because again, I've never been the biggest anime guy. I just heard great things. I heard a lot of great reviews coming out about this. It's also, I believe, the highest grossing anime movie of all time as of right now. So
what?
Yeah, it made a lot of money in theaters. It's actually played I think it played at the Alamo Draft House near me, and it played at one or two other theaters near me. I just didn't get the chance to see it when it was in theaters. But I finally saw it now, and it is well worth checking out. So if you haven't seen it, seek out Your Name, because I don't think you will regret it. I think it's really, really good.
Wow. That's a big recommend.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. Anyway, that about wraps up my discussions, Mike. Let's move on into our featured review of Thor, Motherfucking Ragnarok.
So much has happened since I last saw you. I lost my hammer, yesterday, so that's still pretty fresh.
And then I went on a journey of self-discovery. Where I met you.
Where are we?
You have no idea. Hello, the goddess of death has invaded Asgard.
Oh, I've missed this.
And you and I had a fight recently.
Did I win?
No, I won easily.
Doesn't sound right.
Well, that's true.
All right, that was from the trailer for Thor Ragnarok, the new movie directed by Taika Waititi, written by Eric Pearson, Craig Kyle, and Christopher Yost. It stars Chris Hemsworth, Tom Hiddleston, Kate Blanchett, Idris Elba, Jeff Goldblum, Tessa Thompson, Carl Urban, Mark Ruffalo, and Anthony Hopkins, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Thor Ragnarok reads, "Imprisoned, the almighty Thor finds himself in a lethal gladiatorial contest against the Hulk, his former ally. Thor must fight for survival and race against time to prevent the all-powerful Hela from destroying his home and the Asgardian civilization."
All right. Yeah. Good job, IMDb.
Yes, yes. So, Mike, I've basically liked the Thor movies up to this point. You know, Kenneth Branagh's Thor, which is the original directed by him, is a lot better than I think people give it credit for. You know, it's a fun Phase 1 Marvel movie. You know, it's a grandiose, like, Shakespearean take on Asgard, which I dig about it, and it mixed with, like, this fish-out-of-water comedy. Then there was Alan Taylor's Thor The Dark World, which I would say is one of the weakest Marvel films, kind of often plays like an extended episode of Game of Thrones. Which is what they were going for. Alan Taylor is from Game of Thrones, so it made sense. But it does have its share of like incredibly fun sequences, you know, particularly the breaking out of Asgard heist sequence about halfway through that movie. I don't know. What are your feelings on the first two Thors before we get into our review of Thor Ragnarok?
You know, they're probably the Marvel movies I've seen the least often, but I forgot about Incredible Hulk, so never mind.
So take that for what that's worth.
Yeah. But I definitely remember really enjoying the first Thor. It's like I said, it's been a long time since I've watched it, though. And the same goes for Thor The Dark World. I think I was a little cooler on that. I remember being real upset that they wasted Christopher Eccleston in full body makeup and not speaking English.
Yeah, that was a bummer for sure.
I think because of that, it's, you know, because I haven't seen them very often, I feel like they, you know, I agree with most people, the popular opinion of them being the weaker of the Marvel movies. But that said, I don't dislike them.
Yeah.
So sure, like there's that, I guess. Yeah, they're fun.
I would say the original Thor, I mean, I liked that movie quite a bit when it first came out, but I think part of what I liked about it so much that I was really floored by Chris Hemsworth as Thor. I remember just thinking like, man, he is nailing this character. He's amazing as Thor. And he was my favorite of the Marvel actors for a long time. You know, as soon as Thor came out, I was like, I was waiting for Thor in the Avengers. Like he was the one I was waiting to go see when that movie came out, and all that stuff. So I was pretty excited, for Thor 2. And I was kind of let down by that movie. Like, even though I had fun, like I wasn't like, you know, enthralled by it, I guess. My favorite Marvel character has shifted over the years. Chris Evans as Captain America has kind of become, I think, the one I look to as like the pinnacle of what they're able to do with this universe. But Chris Hemsworth has been doing just phenomenal work as Thor for the past several years. Now, we talked about the first two Thor movies, Mike. I gotta say, I am a much bigger fan of Taika Waititi than I am the Thor movies, who I've talked about on this podcast a lot.
Yeah, you have.
Now, you haven't seen any of his movies, right, Mike? You haven't seen any of the ones before Thor?
No, yeah, which is for shame now.
Yeah.
But I have been aware of What We Do in the Shadows, which I think was like his kind of big breakout, at least in the U.S. kind of thing.
He did a couple movies before that, but What We Do in the Shadows is like the big, like the one that got a lot of critical attention and got, you know, some acclaim in the U.S. Yeah,
and I know you're a very big fan of Hunt for the Wilder People.
Oh, yeah.
So
he's in my top 10 last year.
Yeah, so I, you know, he's definitely a director that I'm going to go back and watch as much of his filmography as I can get my hands on. Absolutely. Probably.
If you have Amazon Prime, What We Do in the Shadows is on there right now.
The new number one. Nick's been telling people he's a vampire. That in turn resulted in an unwanted visit from a vampire hunter. Crime number two. This is quite a biggie, Nick. The vampire hunter who killed Peter. Oh. That should have been crime number one, but we wanted to build up to that. Number three. Deacon doesn't like that you wear the same jackets as him, and he would like you to find your own original style.
For these crimes of which we, the Vampire Council, find you guilty, you should be banished from our flat indefinitely.
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 So I can come back.
No. Indefinitely means there is no end.
I thought there was
no. No, indefinite means that it's not a definite thing. It can
Does
be
it
changed.
Yes, but it's long.
Could be tomorrow. It could be 6 months.
No, it is not tomorrow.
It could be tomorrow.
Forget
it's
about
at
it. Least no, 6 months.
And yeah, I mean, just like I remember a couple years ago when he was announced as the director of Thor Ragnarok, that was enough to just get me sold. Like that made me really excited to see what he could bring to this Marvel universe. And boy, he brought it, man. I mean,
God damn.
So Waititi essentially made a Waititi movie. In the vein of a superhero blockbuster, Thor Ragnarok is basically a full-on comedy. And Waititi has even said, I was listening to he appeared on a podcast that I listened to called Good One, which is a podcast about jokes. Like, and the idea behind that podcast is normally they talk to just like comedians or whatever about jokes that are in their act. But in this most recent episode, they talked to Taika Waititi about a scene from Thor Ragnarok. And it's, you know, just an hour long of him discussing the process of making this movie. And it's a really great listen if you're fascinated by Thor Ragnarok in any way.
That sounds awesome. Holy shit.
It's really cool. And he was even saying, like, about 80% of the dialogue in this movie is improvised. Just completely improvised. Which is a lot for any movie. But, like, for a tightly controlled superhero movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like, that's insane. And you could say, I mean, the original Iron Man had a lot of improvisation going on. But I don't think it was anywhere near the level of what was going on with Thor Ragnarok. Like, it was just, you know, flying, like, it sounded like, you know, they got to the set, they had an idea of what they were doing, and then they were like, all right, let's just riff on this, like, let's do 20 takes, just riff, like, go do whatever. And it kind of sounds like a lot like what Philo and Chris Miller were doing with their Han Solo movie before Disney fired them for that, you know? You know what I mean? And so it sort of makes it more remarkable to me that, like, Marvel is just allowing their filmmakers to kind of go nuts and do whatever they want. And I think this movie kind of exemplifies, like, that, like, the director's voice is coming through in these Marvel superhero movies, whereas in the Star Wars movies, I think Rian Johnson's will come through, as we were talking about before. But, like, with the Phil Lord and Chris Miller thing, it felt like Disney, like, had hired these, like, really talented filmmakers and then kind of, like, were not cool with their process. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things we always talk about when we talk about the Marvel movies and I guess by extension also Star Wars now. But, like, the formula, right? That's always the big complaint for these movies, is they follow the same kind of beats for the most part, and they have the same kind of stuff going on in all of them. But it seems like with this kind of last push of movies, or the upcoming push, you know, Thor, Black Panther.
Yeah.
Well, I can't even remember now. Just everything, you know. Hopefully this new fleet of Marvel movies, they're going to just kind of let their directors do whatever they want, it seems.
Yeah. And I mean, I have felt that they've basically done that for a while. Like, Avengers feels like a Joss Whedon movie. You know, Iron Man 3 feels like a Shane Black movie. The Guardians of the Galaxy movies feel like James Gunn movies. It's felt more so in the past couple of years, I think, than it did at the beginning. Let's get it out of the way now. Mike, what were your overall thoughts on Thor Ragnarok?
This movie's fucking dope. That's the poster quote for me. I had a absolute blast with Thor Ragnarok. I remember hearing about, you know, when it was first announced that the title was first announced, and being like, oh shit, Ragnarok's the apocalypse of Norse mythology.
Right.
This is gonna be a crazy, you know, what we were just doing for the Star Wars stuff is like, oh man, let's make up all this crazy shit. It could be the end of the world. It's gonna be the launch for all this crazy dark stuff, maybe.
Yeah.
LOL. It's a fluorescent psychedelic intergalactic comedy. Like, I'm in. Like, I'm so glad that I was wrong about all those things about what Ragnarok could have been. Yeah, and it makes me really excited to, like, you know, it's like I mentioned, I definitely have to go back and watch all of Waititi's other movies. You know, he's been somebody I've been aware of recently, so this was a superb movie, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it pays off, man, just letting Taika Waititi do his thing, because Thor Ragnarok is a ton of fun. At this point, like, it pretty much goes without saying for a Marvel movie that it's a ton of fun, but, like, I feel like Thor Ragnarok is fun in a different way. You know, it feels like a fresh kind of take on what these Marvel movies are capable of. You know, and Marvel knows how to make engaging stories, enjoyable characters, and they provide you with a good enough time that makes you want to see those characters in more movies, and I feel like Thor Ragnarok does that and more. You know, this feels like a reboot of Thor in a lot of ways. Like, it feels like such a far cry from what those first two movies did. Just as a series and as a character, like, this feels like a totally different take, but within the same continuity, you know? And I feel like that's something that we're familiar, like, people who read comics a lot are familiar with that concept. You know, you read the same comics for years and years, but as a new writer comes on, they'll have, like, a different take on what this character would do or say and stuff like that. And I feel like that's exactly what we're seeing with Thor now. And I think that's pretty cool. I don't, honestly, like, that's neat, I think.
Yeah.
To turn Thor into, like, this much more overtly comedic character. And Hemsworth has always been funny in this role. This movie really takes advantage of his comedic chops. You know, we've seen him, like, be really funny on stuff like Saturday Night Live and in Ghostbusters in particular. Like, people were like, holy shit, Chris Hemsworth's hilarious. And I think part of him being paired up with Taika Waititi, they're both Australian. They both have kind of similar sensibilities. You know, they both have, like, similar senses of humor. So they're able to just kind of, like, riff and improv off of one another until they can, you know, do their own thing. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. There's definitely that sense. You know, I'm not someone that's particularly familiar with kind of the main Marvel comic continuity or something like that, or whatever, however you would phrase that. Like, I've never read the Avengers comic books or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I have seen, you know, pages of it and flip through some of them. And I always kind of pictured Thor, you know, the way Thor is written in the comic books, his dialogue boxes have a different font. He speaks like, "Dost thou," like, you know, that "thee," like he says all those kind of things. Yep. And, you know, it's played for comedic effect and stuff too in that. But it's so funny to see, you know, to picture Thor as that kind of character, which I think he was, especially in Thor 1, which is the part of the whole joke, I guess, you know, the fish out of water thing.
Right.
But now we're just in full blown, like, screwball comedy mode. and you know, one of the things I love that I mentioned, you know, Ant-Man is one of my favorite Marvel movies. You know, they take these huge ideas and condense them into these small scale storylines, which, you know, which I love. As much as I do love the cross, you know, intergalactic stuff and, you know, crazy world-ending things. But my whole point is Thor is all this kind of intergalactic, crazy, you know, dimension-hopping shit wrapped up in this kind of screwball buddy comedy that is so tiny, small scale, and has nothing to do with anything else. And it's so much fun. It's just a joy. It's a joy.
It's a joy, Mike. It's a joy. Yeah, I mean, the cast at large here is just, like, it's nothing short of great. Like, I think Mark Ruffalo is giving his best performance as Bruce Banner in this movie. Just like hands down. Like, I mean, a lot of the time it's like 80% the Hulk, like 20% Mark Ruffalo in this movie. But when Mark Ruffalo is Bruce Banner, I think he's so different than the way we've seen him before. Like, he's so disoriented and like creep, like as you would be, like, in as his circumstances dictate in this movie. Like, he's so disoriented and so like freaked out by everything around him, and he's like just kind of twitchy, and like I really like that kind of take on Bruce Banner in this movie. Like, I think it's like direction for that character. What were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And there's one scene in particular that I'm like 75% sure he's doing Woody Allen. Which is real weird. Like, a real interesting choice for Bruce Banner, but it's fun. Like, it's
I'm
really
curious what scene you mean, but I'm wary of spoilers.
We'll save it.
Yeah. But yeah, and Tessa Thompson is just crushing it as Valkyrie in this movie. So good.
Yeah.
Cate Blanchett just gloriously chewing all the scenery as the villain Hela. Tom Hiddleston being reliably smarmy as Loki is a lot of fun in this movie. And Jeff Goldblum at his Goldblumiest in this movie.
He's playing himself just with blue lipstick. Which might honestly still just be Jeff Goldblum.
That might still be Jeff Goldblum, yeah. And I think just the imagery on display here, there's so much like creativity going on in every frame. I feel like every other scene features like an image that would work perfectly as the cover of a Led Zeppelin album. You know, like, there's a moment early on where you see a silhouette of Thor flying with his hammer being chased by a dragon against the horizon. And it's like one of the coolest like images in any movie. It's such like a perfect like visual distillation of what Thor is about. You know, like that is Thor right there. That's what I want out of Thor. And that's what the other movies like don't really get into that much. Like, I feel like those movies spend a lot of time on Earth. And like Earth is fine, you know, but with Thor, you want him hopping around in space, jumping through different dimensions and stuff like that. Like, that's Thor and like fighting these crazy fantasy creatures. Like, I think the best scene in the original Thor is towards the beginning where they're fighting the frost giants, right? That's like a crazy cool action scene. And you know, you see like all the capabilities of Thor and the Warriors 3 and all that stuff, like that. And then the rest of the movie kind of takes place on Earth, and it's like, all right, like this is cool, but it's not like the full extent of what Thor is capable of. And that's the same thing with Thor 2. There's that big sequence where they're, you know, bolting out of Asgard, like escaping like in this like spaceship, and it's you know, the finale has like these portals going through different dimensions and stuff, and like that's really cool, but that's like maybe 15% of the movie, and then the rest of it is like this earthbound nonsense. And you know, with Thor Ragnarok, every scene is like fucking insane. Like, if you took a moment to describe what's going on in the background of scenes, you would sound like a crazy person. You know what I mean?
And we're about to. but yeah, and I feel like a lot of this movie feels like visually just a giant double middle finger to like the DC grimdark. There's more colors in this movie than there are in all of the DC movies combined, I think.
There's more colors in a single frame of this movie than there is in an entire DC movie.
Exactly. And I love that. I love Waititi's sensibility of a kind of just alien landscape or whatever you want to phrase it. It would be weird. Like, shit would be weird if you're on a different planet in a different dimension. and they just lean into it with this movie and just make shit as weird as they can, and it's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, while the movie is pretty much like squarely focused on providing like a good time, I don't think it's afraid to go a little deeper, like a dig a little deeper. There are emotional beats that land in unexpected ways, and there is like this deeper thematic core criticizing colonialism and the whitewashing of history that is pretty surprising and engaging, and like it's pretty cool. Like that this movie is kind of going there. And Taika Waititi is of Maori descent, so you know obviously he probably has some feelings about colonialism, and so the kind of steeps into this movie in pretty interesting ways. So that. In itself, like the Marvel movies have kind of like flirted with getting more thematic in recent years. Captain America: The Winter Soldier is about government surveillance, and Age of Ultron is about AI and all that stuff. But I feel like this is like its most overt thematic territory it's going for here.
Yeah, I agree, and it's really interesting and cool to see that kind of sensibility. I guess I don't know exactly what word to use. Themes, hashtag themes, hashtag themes. Brought to this kind of, large, silly, colorful blockbuster, but also have really poignant shit to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I do think the movie kind of stumbles a little bit in the beginning, like a little bit at first. I think its first like 10, 15 minutes feel like it's just trying to really quickly wrap up all the cliffhangers from Thor 2. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, all right, we got to get on with our adventure, but we got to wrap up all the other shit that the last filmmaker left us with. So we got to like just real quickly do this, have a quick cameo, fix this up, and like, all right, we're done.
You know? Yeah, and even the end of Ultron, I believe, Age of Ultron. Because I'm pretty sure, doesn't Thor just like disappear? I can't really remember what happens. Yeah, he goes in the pool.
Yeah, Thor goes into the pool. No, he comes back at the end of the movie, but he does leave where he shows up at the beginning of Thor Ragnarok. He's saying, like, you know, save the world a couple times, all this stuff. But at the end of Age of Ultron, he like says goodbye to Tony and Cap, and then he leaves to go deal with what's going on in the Nine Realms and try to bring order and stuff like that.
Right.
Also, will say that Idris Elba, always criminally underused in these Thor movies, also criminally underused here, which is a bummer to see. Like, you know, you're three for three, man. You got to use Idris Elba for something other than just talking with weird eyes. Like, that's like...
Mm-hmm. That's Heimdall's whole character.
Like, there's like one moment in Thor 2 where he, like, stabs a spaceship or something. And I'm like, yeah, Idris Elba, but otherwise, like, he just has done nothing. And it's kind of a bummer. But also... want to give a shout out to Korg, because Korg is perfect and everything he says is the best, and I demand a Korg spinoff.
Mm-hmm. We need a Korg Heimdall spinoff.
I would watch it. And of course Korg is played by Taika Waititi.
He's the purest boy.
Exactly. And just his voice is like just a very like Australian accent that he has going on. But he's like this weird rock creature on an alien planet. It's pretty wild. I would like a Korg spinoff, or if he could be in Infinity War, that would be great.
He's definitely coming back. There's no way he's not.
He has to be. Anyway, is there any other bits about Thor you want to get into, Mike, before we get into spoilers?
Just so much of the aesthetic is such an interesting that's what all we've been talking about, I guess, but it's such an interesting mix, you know, of like 70s like metal and 80s synth pop. There's specifically that shot of the silhouette Thor being chased by the dragon looks like it could be like a Dio cover or a cover of Dio album. But also the soundtrack to this is so synthy and an updated version of stereotypical sci-fi soundtracks.
The score is done by Mark Mothersbaugh, who has scored a lot of movies. He scored a lot of Phil Lord Chris Miller movies, but he is most well known as the founding member of Devo.
There you go. That explains a lot of that. And it's just a lot of fun. It's used to such great effect in this movie, I think. And there's some specific scenes, I guess we'll get into, that are just fucking rad in spoilers. But there's a lot of just cool frames that, like, I would like to print out.
All them cool frames and stuff like that.
Yeah, man.
And I mean, just as sequences go on, like, Taika Waititi was talking about this on Good One podcast, but he was talking about how, you know, you watch a lot of Hollywood blockbusters and you hear a joke in a blockbuster and it can be funny, but it's also it's noticeably written like 6 months in advance, like before the role was even cast, stuff like that. So you don't have like a sense of like the performer's timing. And in this, like, you have jokes, but then you have jokes on top of those jokes and jokes on top of those jokes. And you have like just conversations that are filled with like nonstop like jokes a lot of the time. And it like creates like this different kind of vibe that you're getting out of this movie. And so it's almost like disorienting at first, because you're like, what am I watching almost? You know, because you're used to how superhero movies tend to feel and how they tend to be written. And this one isn't so much written as it is just like kind of bumbling along. Like we have these
like Thor.
Yeah. These really clever, actors and writers and stuff, just like improvising stuff and like doing 20 different takes and kind of cutting them all together and like whatever the best one is works. And it worked out really well for Thor Ragnarok, and I really hope Taika Waititi comes back for a Thor 4 if there's a Thor 4, because like I feel like there should be. I feel like at this point, like, they've rebooted Thor so well with this movie, and I think Chris Hemsworth would want to do more. Like it seems
I think so too.
Like,
yeah,
compared to like Chris Evans or Robert Downey Jr., where they've always seemed like, okay, we're like coming to the end of our contract. Chris Hemsworth by contrast has always been like, yeah, I'll do more Thor. Like what else have I got going on? Let's
see. Yeah, come on. You already did Cabin in the Woods. What else is left?
Yeah, exactly. So I am eager to see more Thor in the future. Obviously he'll be in Infinity War, but I would love if there was more Taika Waititi Thor in the future. But we'll see what happens. But in the meantime, Mike, should we move on to spoilers? Spoilers?
Yes.
Okay, let's do that. Let's move on to spoilers for Thor Ragnarok, starting right now. All right, it's time for spoilers for Thor Ragnarok, starting right now. So, Mike, this movie ends with the destruction of Asgard, man. That's pretty major in terms of, like, I mean, like, obviously the movie's called Ragnarok, so you might assume that might happen. But I figured the movie would be about them preventing the destruction of Asgard. Turns out, no, not the case.
Incorrect.
But I think that it really worked for me, like, as a thematic, like, continuation of what's going on. Like, Odin describes to Thor that Asgard isn't a place, it's the people, and so they are able to evacuate all the surviving Asgardians and get on a spaceship and head to Earth. And that is where we are at for Infinity War right now, which, you know, is a cool setup, I think. Like, it could include a lot of Asgardians, could include Korg, he's on that spaceship, you never know.
He's going to be important.
One of my favorite lines in the movie is Korg just like talking to Loki, like, hey man, we're all going to go on that big spaceship. Want to come?
Yeah. He says that to a bunch of people, and it's like the best thing ever.
It's so casual. It's great. Yeah. But yeah, also want to give a shout out to that Doctor Strange cameo.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, because that was cool. That's in like, that first 10-15 minutes where the movie is kind of like trying to catch you up on like all this stuff, like just try to wrap up all those cliffhangers from Thor 2 that were left dangling.
Yeah.
And I think we knew Doctor Strange was going to be in it because the post-credit scene of Doctor Strange where it's implied that he'll be in this movie. But yeah, it was a fun little cameo, like a reminder that Doctor Strange exists and that it is kind of taking advantage of that whole shared universe concept that Marvel has. It kind of felt like when Falcon showed up in Ant-Man to me.
Right.
You know, just pops up for a scene, does his thing, and then he's out. And, you know, you're watching a Thor movie, but Doctor Strange can show up too for a bit. Like, why not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the comic book thing. You know, reading All New Wolverine, and they need help with something, they go ask Doctor Strange, because he's the Sorcerer Supreme, and he'll know. And, you know, Thor can do that too. And now we have that in movies, that it's fun.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Anyway, yeah, so are there scenes that you wanted to bring up, Mike? Any specific stuff that you wanted to point out?
So there's the scene where I think Mark Ruffalo is doing Woody Allen, is when after he turns into Banner for the first time, and he's dressed in Tony Stark's clothes, and Thor's kind of like, you know, I need you to come help me go to Asgard and defeat these monsters. And Banner is kind of like, you just want me to be the Hulk. And like that whole exchange is just Ruffalo is doing a weird voice, and he's kind of like twitchy and fidgety, and he's being real nasally and neurotic about what he is. And it just felt like he's doing that character.
Okay.
But that was all. Yeah, that was just fun.
That's kind of what I was talking about before, how Banner just like is portrayed so completely differently, like totally disoriented and like out of it and like twitchy and like just really, like, really weird, like weirded out by everything around him, and he's distracted because like he's been Hulk for 2 years at this point.
Yeah.
And you know, when he changes back, he has no memory of what's been going on, so he finds himself on this weird alien planet. So he's like constantly distracted by everything around him, and like, you know, his mind's not totally right because he's been Hulk for 2 years, so he's like just still synapses are still firing in his brain. And it's I think the way Ruffalo portrays that is really funny. Like it allows for a lot of really good exchanges with Thor. Like the two of them together just bantering back and forth is hilarious. But I think it also like just speaks to how effective that portrayal of Banner is. And I think it'll probably be toned down a little bit once he gets back to Earth and stuff. But I hope there is still that kind of like fidgetiness to Banner going forward, because I really like that portrayal of of Banner. But I think that also kind of ties into the emotional beat in this movie that really worked for me. So I think there are emotional beats throughout the movie, and they're kind of, a lot of them are undercut by like humor and stuff like that, or like, you know, like the emotional beat almost we play for a joke. But the one that really worked for me, like, you go, aw, is when the Hulk is attacking Thor in the Quinjet, the video of Black Widow starts playing, and it's her video message from Age of Ultron.
Right.
And that's when Bruce Banner, the Hulk sees it, and he starts transforming back into Bruce Banner, and he's just like freaking out, and it's really sad, and like,
yeah,
it's an example of like, I think, how powerful this like long form storytelling can be that Marvel is doing. You know, that's something that a lot of people didn't like, the relationship between Banner and Black Widow in Age of Ultron. I personally really like it. But the way that movie leaves Hulk, like, it just feels like gone off on his own, and we've seen Black Widow since she was in Civil War, and it wasn't really brought up then, but I feel like just that moment felt like the culmination of everything we've felt since Age of Ultron. Like, it felt like that emotional beat that I was waiting for. Cause I found myself wondering about that. Like, I wonder how if Hulk even remembers Black Widow and stuff like that. And, that was a really nice thing to see, I thought. Otherwise, other stuff in the movie. I mean, the Warriors 3 die almost immediately. Which is kind of nuts, kind of a bummer. Cause I did like those characters in the first two movies, even though they were like, not like huge roles, but they were like semi-significant supporting roles. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They make Thor what he is for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, they, I think it's Fandral and Volstagg die immediately, like as soon as Hela shows up. And then Hogan gets in a little fight, but he dies pretty quickly too. No, Sif is not there, noticeably. Sif is not in this movie. Jamie Alexander from the first two movies. And I'm assuming that's because she was off filming Blindspot. But that means that she could still be alive somewhere, could show up in Infinity War, you never know.
Yeah, who knows? Why not? Every other human is in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone that wasn't in Murder on the Orient Express is gonna be in Infinity War.
I was mentally running through the Murder on the Orient Express cast list in my head just to make sure that nobody in that was in Infinity War.
as far as I know,
and I think you're right, although Michelle Pfeiffer is an Ant-Man and the Wasp, so
I was close.
Boom.
I was close.
She probably won't be in Infinity War though, so you're
yeah,
you're
that's true.
But yeah, otherwise, also, actually, speaking of the Hulk Black Widow thing, I did really love the way Thor kept doing Black Widow's like the sun's going down thing from Age of Ultron to try
to sun's getting real low.
The sun's getting real low. Hey big guy, sun's getting real low. Which, again, was a pretty like a fun, like emotional moment in Age of Ultron when that happened, and this movie plays completely for laughs. And
I love, like you said, that the ability of the long form storytelling thing to just be able to call that back and just turn it into a total joke is so much fun.
It's so good, so good. So I did want to talk about Hela a little bit as Cate Blanchett, just crushing it in this movie, and also Scourge, played by Carl Urban. I mean, what did you think of Scourge? Did that feel extraneous to you in any way, or were you invested in his character at all?
I wasn't particularly invested in his character at all, other than his assault rifle jokes. Getting ready for those the whole movie, basically.
Yeah, those are pretty good.
The literal gun, like Chekhov's gun, which is fine. But I don't know. I didn't really particularly care about him. I don't remember if he was in any of the other movies. Been a while.
This is the first one he's in, yeah.
I didn't know if he was introduced at the end of Dark World or something like that. But yeah, sure. Like, whatever. I like Carl Urban. He's fun. Him and Cate Blanchett are fun. Cate Blanchett's amazing, I think, in this as Hela. She is just leaning into everything and just being insane. Yes. And it's like, it's the dopest.
Absolutely. And the movie doesn't explicitly kill Hela either. I'm positive she's going to show up in either Infinity War or Avengers 4 to really cause some shit. I mean, she's the goddess of death, and the whole thing with Thanos is that he's in love with death, like the personification of death. So I assume.
Oh shit! I never even thought of that.
So I'm assuming that Hela will show up at some point in one of those two movies. I think that's why you don't see her like explicitly get killed. But the destruction of Thor's hammer, like early on in the movie, like where Hela just like obliterates it, is just such a great like stakes raising moment of like, oh shit, because we like there's a couple things we know about Thor, and the fact that his hammer is indestructible and that only he can hold it is one of them. And I think that was used to really great effect in Age of Ultron, where they have the whole trying to lift the hammer contest and nobody can do it. Captain America almost does it and Thor freaks out for a bit, which is really funny. But then towards the end of that movie, Vision shows up and Vision just like hands Thor his hammer.
Yeah,
and that I remember when that happened in Age of Ultron, and the entire theater just like going silent, like holy shit, because that was such a huge like that's such a great character moment and a great like moment where you can like, oh, we can trust Vision now. He can raise Thor's hammer. That's nobody can do that but Thor. And so when Hela like grabs the hammer and just destroys it immediately, that's such a great like raising of the stakes moment that I think works really well. And he never gets it back by the end. He never is has a new hammer. I'm assuming by Infinity War he'll probably forge a new one. That's my guess.
Yeah, somebody will make a new one for him somewhere, I'm sure.
But I do look forward to the scene where Thor and Nick Fury go eye patch shopping together, and that'll be a lot of
fun. Oh, my God. Yeah, I did appreciate that character detail, you know, making him more Odin, you know.
Yeah, he's more – like, by the end of the movie, he's King of Asgard. He has the eye patch. He's more like his father in that respect. And it is, like, kind of the closure of his character arc from the first movie where, you know, he's kind of rejecting the throne in that movie. And, you know, Loki wants to be the king, and Thor – doesn't, but Loki can't be the king because he's Loki, and obviously that would be a terrible idea. So I think that, like, the fact of him kind of accepting his role as King of Asgard, but also, like, you know, it's opens it up for many more new Thor stories. This feels like a new chapter for Asgard and a new chapter for Thor. You know, like, I don't picture Thor sitting on the throne of Asgard anymore, partially because Asgard doesn't exist anymore. But he just doesn't seem like the guy like Odin who will just be chilling and, you know, hanging out in the Asgard throne room. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It'd be kind of crazy if they go with the, you know, it'd be a shame if they do this since they've had the success. And like you said, they've rebooted Thor effectively at this point. But if they go with the comic book route where, you know, Thor, as we know him, this character becomes Odin's son, and then the next wielder of meow, whatever the fuck, the hammer, Mjolnir, becomes, you know, the god of thunder, and we follow this new Thor. It would be crazy to see them do that. You know, I'm sure that's never going to happen, but it's a possibility, I guess.
I can see it happening. I mean, in the comics right now, I don't know if it's still going on, but there was Lady Thor. Or it's just called Thor, but it's a woman Thor.
A woman,
And it's Jane Foster in the comics. I don't think that'll happen right now because Natalie Portman is not in this movie.
Nope.
And they do, like, they kind of briefly address that very early on in the movie. Thor and Loki are on Earth, and, like, two girls, like, take a selfie with Thor, and Loki has, like, the eye roll thing going on. Like, oh, here we go. And it's like, oh, sorry to hear that Jane dumped you. And Thor was like, oh, no, it was a mutual dumping or whatever. Something along those lines. And that's pretty much all you get out of what happened with Jane Foster. And it seems like this she is not on this movie's mind at all. But it is one of those things where it's like, okay, we have to wrap, like, random threads from Thor to, like, explain why Jane Foster's not there. It kind of felt like, I remember in Transformers 3, it's that they have to explain why Megan Fox isn't there. And it kind of felt the same way, where it's just like one line where it's like, ah, oh, too bad that bitch dumped him or something. Like,
yeah, like
that's,
pretty much.
That's Michael Bay humor. But, like, it's... I think this movie plays that a lot better. So in the first Thor, there is this Easter egg in Odin's throne room where you see the Infinity Gauntlet. And, you know, obviously Thanos is part of the Infinity Gauntlet. Like, he has an Infinity Gauntlet. So it's like, well, people have been wondering for years, like, well, how is there an Infinity Gauntlet in Odin's throne room if Thanos has one? And they finally answered that in this movie, which I thought was pretty funny. Kate Blanchett comes in and was just like, yep, everything in this throne room is fake. And she, like, knocks over the Infinity Gauntlet. Which, like, it works in keeping with the movie's, like, whitewashing of colonial history type theme. Where it's, you know, like this criticism of colonialism and, like, this kind of putting up this front of, you know, this peaceful prosperity that over this, like, war-torn land kind of thing. But, yeah, I thought that was a pretty funny way to address the Easter egg. It's something that nobody except hardcore Marvel fans cared about at all.
Yeah.
But it is something they address, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and there's, I think, you know, we have the setup for Infinity War, I think, in those moments, or towards the end there in the vault or whatever, when Loki passes the Tesseract and he stops and looks at it. I'm sure he takes it, right?
Yeah, 100%. There's no way he doesn't.
So we got that, which is cool. But I guess before we get into the post-credits stuff, or, you know, where we think this movie is going, or, you know, where the story is going, I want to bring up, there's a couple moments I want to shout out, I guess. Valkyrie, Tessa Thompson, is dope. I'm glad she's absolutely a character now. I can't wait. I hope she's in more more movies. I believe
she's confirmed to be in Infinity War, at least.
There's been a huge audience reaction to her character. Yes. But there's a scene when Loki finds out she's a Valkyrie, and he says, oh, that must be, you know, he knows the story of what happened to the Valkyrie and why she's the last one left. And we see, he makes her see her memory.
Right.
And it's this kind of like painting storybook slow-mo thing. And it reminded me a lot. We saw something similar, I think, in the kind of like prologue of Wonder Woman, where Antiope, I think, or Hippolyta, I can't remember which,
I remember
is telling Diana the story of the Amazons, and it's this kind of same kind of thing, but it looks fucking dope, way doper in Thor. Yeah, and it's just kind of like slow-mo painting battle scene between the Valkyrie and Hela, and, you know, Hela defeating the Valkyrie, and I can't remember her actual name. Is her actual name just Valkyrie? I can't remember.
They don't actually give her a name, I think they call her Scrapper 142 or something.
Yeah,
But they don't actually give her a name in the movie, I don't think.
Yeah, and you know, her defeat and why she's the last one left, and it's beautiful. It's so cool to look at. Yeah. And I was reading some article. I didn't get the chance to read all the way through it, but they invented some rig that allowed them to film that way, like this new technique to film stuff in that fashion. Yeah, it's kind of the opposite, apparently. The way I understood it from my quick glance is like the opposite of the bullet time thing from The Matrix, where instead of a ring of cameras taking a picture, it's a ring of lights. It's like some weird new rig thing they invented, and it looks cool, and I hope it shows up a lot more and more stuff.
nice. Yeah, that was a cool scene. Is there other stuff you wanted to shout out, Mike?
I think it happens, like, the same exact thing happens with Valkyrie at the end, I think, when she comes out of the the spaceship with the fireworks at the big battle on the bridge, Bifrost Bridge or whatever.
She's one of shout out badass moments with Valkyrie, it sounds like.
Like, how could you not? She's fucking awesome.
Yeah, no, she is fantastic. I also want to give a shout out to the Hulk during the final battle, particularly, but there's a hilarious moment where Mark Ruffalo jumps from the spaceship and says, like, you'll see what happens, and like he's falling, and you expect him to turn into the Hulk when he lands, and he just fucking falls flat on his face as Bruce Banner, and it's hilarious. And then it's like so cathartic when a second later, you know, the camera's off of him, and you see the demon, and you hear the demon get like pulled, and then it's the Hulk just like, bro. Like ripping the demon back, and it's like that's cool. But also just the shot of the Hulk just jumping at Sartor, the gigantic monster thing.
Yes,
just fucking that's an amazing image right there. You know, and I think this movie CG, like it's a very CG heavy movie. Obviously, it's a superhero movie. I don't think the CGI always looks perfect, but it does. It kind of gives the movie like this Saturday morning cartoon type feel, which I enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it.
Yeah, but anyway, we should talk about some of the post credit scenes. There are two of them, as is the norm with Marvel movies now, and they're pretty straightforward ones, I think, for this one. I mean, there's the first one, the mid credit scene, where it's Thor and Loki on their spaceship, and they're like on their way to Earth, and then suddenly this gigantic spaceship shows up, and they're like, oh shit. Theoretically, that is probably Thanos' spaceship, I would imagine.
It reminded me of the Dark Aster, I think is the name, from Ronan's spaceship a little bit from Guardians of the Galaxy 1.
I'm amazed that you remember the name of Ronan's spaceship in Guardians of the Galaxy.
I can't believe that I remembered that either, but it just happened. I surprised even myself sometimes.
If you put a gun to my head...
That might not be the right name.
It would have taken me a minute to come up with the name Ronan from Guardians of the Galaxy. You know,
I just had it in my back pocket waiting for an opportunity. But yeah, it kind of reminded me of that, which confused me. I didn't guess that it was that. I would have not guessed that for some dumb reason. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense. We're popping. Infinity War is popping off. Yeah,
it's happening, man. Less than a year away. It's insane that it's almost.
Wait, what?
It's coming out in May, man.
Holy shit.
It's like 7 months from now. It's coming out soon.
And time moves too fast.
We'll probably see a trailer before Star Wars is what's going to happen. Like
that just means the calamity is more imminent than I thought.
Yeah, and we still got Black Panther in the meantime. Tied us
holy
over
shit.
In February, which looks fucking dope.
Yeah, so I think the new trailer for it, I guess. I hadn't seen the trailer in a while before Thor, and holy shit.
Yeah, that's going to make – honestly, that might be Marvel's biggest hit. Like that's –
I really hope so.
It might not make more money than like Avengers Infinity War, but I think it's going to be huge. Like it's like there is so much hype for Black Panther. But anyway, the second post-credit scene is just like a comedy bit, which has tended to be the case with a lot of these Marvel movies now. Like Spider-Man Homecoming ended with Captain America doing his like little PSA thing, and half of the Guardians post-credit scenes were comedy jokes, and there was five of them in that movie. This is Jeff Goldblum's Grandmaster showing up. Just sees like the people who have been rebelling against him, and is like, all right, good rebellion, folks. We can wrap this up. I think we've all done a good job here. Obviously, you need someone to rebel against, and I think I've filled that role admirably. And
we'll call it a tie.
Yeah. It's pretty funny. It's a pretty funny bit. Jeff Goldblum is always hilarious. I love the fact that his ship is an orgy ship that they're on, which is just like a random joke. But I don't know. It's good stuff, man. I'm just a fan of Thor Ragnarok, a fan of Taika Waititi. I'm glad that he was able to just do his own thing on this massive Marvel canvas, and I'm glad that Marvel's allowing filmmakers to kind of just do that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm excited to see the future of Thor as a fixture in the Marvel cinematic universe. I kind of assumed that these kind of tentpole characters might go away, like Iron Man and Captain America and Thor, just by nature of like contracts. They might shift to like the new Avengers or whatever, or right. Actually do that kind of thing. But after this, I'm not so sure. I kind of hope he sticks around. We'll see what happens.
I think what's going to happen is there will be a shift, and there will be like some newer characters are going to take the place of older ones. But I think Thor might stick. I think Chris Hemsworth seems like he's still really into it. And Taika Waititi said he would do another one if they asked him to. And fucking do it.
why not?
Why not? You've got such a great cast now. Like this new like ensemble that they've assembled for Thor Ragnarok with Chris Hemsworth, Tom Hiddleston, Mark Ruffalo, and Tessa Thompson. Like that's a perfect cast of characters right there. I would love to see those characters on a new adventure together. Please make that happen for Thor 4 is all I ask. And hopefully Taika Waititi is on board for that. And I think he is. And hopefully he gets another movie out pretty soon. I think he's working on a stop motion animated movie about Michael Jackson's chimp Bubbles. And
yes.
I can't wait.
And he also announced We're Wolves, sequel to What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes, he talked about that a little while ago, but it sounds like that's actually happening now, which is pretty great. So pretty excited about that. So Taika Waititi is not going away anytime soon, and I'm very, very glad about that. So yeah, big fans of Thor Ragnarok right here. Obviously, it's a Marvel movie. Obviously, we're going to dig it. So that about wraps up this week's episode of Film Bookcast. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/... Don't laugh. Don't laugh, Mike.
I'm not laughing. I'm just smiling, Mike.
Don't be happy. No.
Don't allow joy to seep into this podcast.
Yes. Yes. How dare you? You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. I also got some more at crookedmarquee.com. You can check that out there. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's Cree Show. If you're listening to this on iTunes, subscribe, rate, take a moment to give us a review. Feedback, compliments, topics, discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. We would love to hear from you, so definitely send us an email. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where I think we're jumping from Marvel to DC, Mike. It's time, man. Pray for us as we take on Justice League. This will be interesting. I have heard the reactions are out now. Critical reactions are out, and they are decidedly mixed. So,
yeah,
which honestly is better than I was expecting. So, we'll see what happens. I've been seeing a lot of like lukewarm, like it's kind of fun reactions, but I feel like those are going to give way to like, man, this movie sucks. So. So we'll see what happens. But you can check out our next Complete Works next week, where we're talking about Nicolas Cage's role in 2007's Next, the Philip K. Dick adaptation. So thank you so much for listening, guys, and we are out.
Right. I will protect Asgard with my last and every breath.
It's main event time.
I am the goddess of death.
Oh, what?